With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, a new episode on a Monday. That's because I will be in Amsterdam this week recording How to Lend Money to Strangers live at Money 2020 Europe. And to celebrate that, I will be releasing a new episode every day this week. This chat of mine with Bartek being the first of those.
Open banking can create actually something which is and will be difficult for banks, because if I get the customer consent, it means that I have access to the most important historical data, the transactional data from your account. And having that, I can actually transfer those information into my own models. Even if I see this client for the first time in my life, it's not a stranger anymore. I always imagined myself as a lawyer in America. Then I realized that American court and Polish court is a little bit different thing. And somebody called me and I said, listen, we need actually a good someone who understands what mortgage is, because we are just issuing the mortgage business and nobody understands how it works. So perhaps you should join us. I said, yeah, I can try for a month or two. And I stayed forever.
You may have seen lending change during your career, but have you seen Poland levels of change? You may have seen fax machines and checks and nothing but manual in-person processes become APIs and digital wallets and selfie-based KYC checks. Bartek Staszewski has seen that happen too. But while he was in high school, he also saw Poland emerge free from the ruins of the USSR. And then, a few years into his career, he saw Poland join the EU. Welcome to How to Lend Money to Strangers with Brendan LaGrange. Bartek Staszewski, welcome to the show. You and I started in the credit industry only 2 years apart, which is refreshing for me because as I speak to you, I've just finished editing an episode with a fintech founder who was in kindergarten at that time. But while we started at pretty much the same time in terms of our careers, those careers started on the opposite sides of the world. So tell me, before we get into the nuts and bolts of what you're doing now, how did you get into credit and where has your 20-year career taken you?
First of all, let me thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to join you. And yes, it was a long time ago. I started in the finance industry exactly in the year 2000. The Olympics were in Sydney. Concord plane was still flying. People were listening to It's My Life by Jon Bon Jovi. And it was, a completely different reality. So I started in General Electric Consumer Finance. This was a pretty new business in Poland. GE bought business in Poland. They brought expats, they brought external managers from US and then tried to understand mentality of people, the employees and the consumers. And we were trying to understand mentality and expectations of our American bosses. This was a very exciting learning curve from both ends. This was also the time where Citibank was quite present in the Polish market. And they were popularizing credit cards. And if you had a golden card of Citibank, you were someone. I spent 8 years with GE. I was working for operations and for risk management. And then I started my path in the market. So I was working for Citibank, for UniCredit, for KBC, the Belgian group, and for many other institutions as consultants. And finally, today, I ended up in Experian as a global consultant supporting clients in risk management and usage of Experian software. I had a chance maybe to see two cycles of economy. Because in 2004, Poland accessed the European Union and, the wave of optimism, extreme optimism, I should say. And then there was a big crash in 2008 and the consequences of actions and, let's be honest, mistakes that were taken before. And then you've seen the attempts from the regulator and the whole industry to keep up and an emergence of data. And then there was attempt to regulate the data and so on and so on. So extreme change. Because, when I started, the mortgage application was 30 pages of paper. And it took 2 months to process it. And today it's in hours.
Yeah. And what I think makes the story so interesting is that the change you've seen happening is driven by two huge factors. So on the one hand, you've got massive changes in what it means to be Polish, what the Polish economy looks like, all that geopolitical stuff happening, driving a lot of social, cultural, technology changes. And then on the other side, you've got the whole world changing, you know, all the technology, all the digitization. So both of those making the world look very different today than it did at the start of your career. So to give us some context, maybe what did it look like 20 years ago when you started in lending? What did the credit world look like?
I will go back even a bit further. 1989, Poland regained its freedom and the government introduces the capitalism, but there is nothing. There is no infrastructure. There is no legal backgrounds. The country is quite poor. And the credit market, as we know it today, it did not exist. It had to be created. That's a simplification, but you can say there was one bank in whole Poland. Then this bank was divided into smaller parts. It was sold to the foreign investors. They invested their know-how and the capital and everything changed. And in 1994, there was a new banking law passed. It was very modern. It was, I think, copy-pasted from the Western laws. But what was, you know, really the difference, the change? The banks completely didn't know their customers. It was like you were lending to complete strangers. Even if those customers were your customers, they were doing a daily banking with you, you were still starting to learn about those clients, about their behaviors, about what they do.
Yeah, I remember the introduction of the first know your customer rules and how little the bank used to know about their customer back in those days.
Exactly. And imagine the first credit bureau, the professional credit bureau in Poland was created back in 1997. Before that, there was not even exchange of information about the client. So you had to have very, very big and strong trust in what customer tells you and in the papers that customer brings you. And you can imagine in such environment, the first generic scorecards, they were something new and wonderful. They were bringing the absolute new quality and understanding to how credit process can be created. This was really, really exciting and interesting. We started to build the credit verification. This could take weeks and customer simply waited and they waited patiently. Customer to get a loan had to show not only the perfect credit worthiness and good earnings and absolutely crystal clear past in the repayments, but in fact, bring a lot of papers, a lot of certificates. And you know, sometimes it was funny when I was discussing with the risk managers, the experts, and they expected to see the documents that don't exist or were completely worthless, like payslips. My manager said customers should bring a payslip. And I said, but why? Payslip actually means nothing. No, you are wrong, he said. Payslip is very important. You can take your payslips everywhere and, you know, everyone trusts in the payslips. I said, not in this country. You can take the payslips and, in fact, you can actually write something on it, like your shopping list or something, and actually it doesn't matter. Nobody cares about it. You have to have, you know, a certificate, a stamp. Somebody has to sign it. Then you have to call this person and ask if this is right. And this was the type of discussion we had. But honestly, it was growing very fast. It was growing very firmly. And I remember in 2004, the lending processes were absolutely masterpiece. Very strong operations, very well organized, with pretty good software behind it, with pretty good decisioning software behind it too. And for the consumer market, you could take a loan in minutes. So, you know, in 10 years from the scratch, it was built very, very well.
Yeah, and let's talk about where that's ended up. Obviously, the market today is very different from 20 years ago when you started.
The market changed completely. Certainly, the processing time for applications, whether this is cash loan or mortgages, is reduced significantly. I'm talking about Poland, but in fact, these are the processes that I'm observing all across the Europe. It's pretty much the same way that everybody's taking, but in some countries, it takes longer time than in others to do that. But the market is now undoubtedly very heavily regulated by the Polish regulator. And most of the sector is subject to supervision. So banks, cooperative banks, and actually, as we speak, the payday loans, so non-banking financial providers, are getting under the KNF regulatory too. From the point of view of consumer that is taking a loan, it means kind of standardization of the documents that you may expect, about the requirements from the lending sites, and I think this is good. After the accession into European Union, this was also followed into very heavy investment in infrastructure and digitalization. And right now, the market is very largely digitalized. In principle, anyone who has a bank account is able to obtain an unsecured loan online within minutes and secured mortgage loan maybe within the days. The banks that has their own customers, those customers don't even have to apply. The pre-approved offers are waiting for them. In secured products, in mortgage products, I would say that the market is attempting to digitalize that process, and they are trying to make the mortgage lending available 100% online. I think that the biggest bank in Poland right now committed that within 3 years they want to have 100% digitalized mortgage. On top of that, I think I should mention that there is also quite a few fintechs in the market, the global and the local ones. They are present here and they are doing the job also. They are focused on building seamless processes for their clients, providing very high-end user experience and very convenient apps. What was even 2010 high-end, today it's a commodity. This is, for me, very amazing. And sometimes I'm pretty scared when I start to think how this will end in the next 10 years.
Yeah, South Africa's history is very different, but also some of the timelines quite similar in terms of when we reemerged back into the global marketplace around the mid-90s. You go back to what it looked like 20 years ago on some of these ideas that maybe were fanciful even 10 years ago to think that everybody's doing it and you can do it for all your products.
There was a few, let's say, paths that market went and it was dead end. I think it was 2012, and everybody was very excited about NLP, natural language processing. Immediately build the engines, we will start converting voice to text and text to information, we will analyze the information, we will get an insight out of it, maybe put very fast decision engine behind it. True, I was also one of those that was misled into this path, and I remember we spent a lot of time on it. But at the end of the day, I can point that there is quite advanced usage of chatbots in collections process, especially in early collections, but no more of that. There was a very strong research about how to get if customer is speaking the truth when making promise to pay. So there was a voice analysis, I mean the tone of voice, also what customer said. And based on that, the agent in collections was supposed to take a decision whether agree on the PTP or rather accelerate. This is a fantastic theory, but in fact hardly ever it really works. Right now, the hot topic in the market is open banking. Everybody talks about it. And I still believe that this is and will be a market change.
And I've seen you speaking on it. So it'd be quite interesting to hear your thoughts on how that's rolling out in Poland. Obviously, I'm based in the UK at the moment, which sees itself as sort of the spiritual home of open banking.
Yes, so it is a very interesting topic. And it has a couple of levels that we should discuss. But definitely, it is a very interesting story. Many experts thought that this will be a game changer immediately when it was implemented. I thought so too. And imagination was that, we are technologically advanced, so we will attack the big banks, that they are, the whales, and they act slowly. But it never happened. The changes are, I would say, step by step. They are not that rapid. This is evolution, not the revolution. What happened? Firstly, some of the big banks, they decided to slightly delay adopting to the standards. It turned out that the customers, they were not particularly willing to hand over the data and to provide the consent. Actually, the COVID pandemic and lockdown, many customers were by force to transit from, let's say, being branch customers to being digital world customers. Those customers started to be the point of attack and point of interest for the fraudsters that wanted to take over their data. And if I was to tell you what is the second most important topic in the market, this is exactly that. So this is the digital security and how to protect your money from the fraudsters. So banks started to issue the fraud awareness campaigns, and they were trying to teach their customers not to click the links, not to share the data, not to talk with somebody who calls you and tells he or she is a bank's agent and so on. And this could have an impact on open banking because customers started to look at their data as something much more valuable than before. And that this should be a deal that I give you my data, but you have to give me something in exchange. And apparently the time of processing or your convenience, it was not enough. My expectations towards open banking was quite simple. So I imagined that there will be a marketplace in which the lenders will position their offers. And there will be also someone who will integrate those offers and will process the customer's data. And at the end of the day, there will be kind of a, let's say, trade who gives less. So the smallest margin will win. So my expectation was that the premium from the open banking will go to the client. I've seen at least two operators like that, but I think that they entered in the market a little bit too fast. So they are already gone from the market. But I think this will reappear. The market is slowly building up. The open banking is slowly building up. All the professionals see the great value in it after all.
I think one of the tricky things in that kind of model is that the value of data is at scale. You know, you get a lot of value out of it when you've got a million records, 100,000 records. But for the consumer, when you try and give them their share of the monetization, it's a couple of cents. And that's where somebody has to get that model right. How do you make it feel like the right incentive to the consumer when it's inbuilt and you've got a good service and that service needs open banking? I think that value discussion's easy. But when you turn it to money, it suddenly says, well, for 10 cents, I'm not going to do it. Or for a dollar, I'm not going to do it. You're right. It's an interesting space because we have spent so much time warning people of things like phishing. Somebody's going to make an app that looks like your bank app to steal your data. And then when you use open banking, you know, it pops up with your banking app and people are suspicious. So now we've trained all the right habits, but we've got to get people now to understand what's open banking versus what's a fraud attempt, which is harder. And the whole world's been speaking the last decade about data and the value of data. And now we're saying, please give me more data and give it to me for free. We've now got to have that difficult conversation. But as you said, yeah, the professionals, we can see the value in it. It's great value, but it's that communication side that's tricky. You know, the technology arrives, but culturally, it's now a harder time to make that work.
Exactly. I hate when someone use the example of their own children when speaking about the business, but I think I have to do it right now because I have an adult daughter. And I asked her once, okay, listen, how the loyalty to your vendors is important to you? Like, she said, listen, it doesn't matter. I just need a quality of service. If I get the quality of service, I go where it's more convenient to me. I can drink a coffee in shop A, in shop B, if this is delicious enough in both of them, that works for me. And I think that this means that open banking can create actually something which is and will be difficult for banks because they work a lot in the past to have the loyal clients. There are marketing departments who are calculating the value of customers' relationship. They are measuring how much time customers spend with us, what is the usage of the app, how clients are using that. But with the open banking, if I get the customer consent, it means that I have access to the most important historical data, I mean the transactional data from your account. And having that, I can actually transfer those information into my own models. Even if I see this client for the first time in my life, it's not a stranger anymore. I know how to calculate PD of this client. I know how to calculate fraud score for this client. I know which kind of device this client is using and what is the footprint of this device. Calculating the credit capacity is a piece of cake for me, and I know that I'm 100% compliant with all the regulations. I'm talking about a simple product now, right? If we are talking about the loan, like let's say for a 1 million, whatever currency, and buying a house, yeah, that's a different. Because other way around, I heard the opinion, and it was from Ireland actually, that the process was too fast, and the clients didn't like that because they didn't felt secure. So they said, but we want someone in the bank to think about it, to consider our situation, to look at it seriously and, you know, respond whether we should take this loan or not. While in the bank, there was a thinking like, let's do it very, very fast. But it turned out that that client is buying a house or a flat. But the bank is also important in that. If bank check my property, then it means that this is a good property and I'm a good client. I don't know if this is still valid or not because it's changing rapidly, but there was a case like that.
You do take comfort as a home buyer that, well, the banks valued the house too, you know, cool-headed third party. They've looked at the house and said, okay, it is worth what you're paying for it. And they've looked at your income and said, you can afford this. And they've thought about your future for 25, 30, even 40 years and agree that this is, you know, a comfortable investment to make. But it's that understanding as well, the decision part can be really fast. Like, we are going to give you the mortgage. Now we're just going to check the house or something, you know, it's about understanding what the customer values very fast. And that's getting rid of the stress.
Question is also how the consumers will use the rights to understand what's happening with their data. This is something that also can evolve. I assume that it will evolve into a marketplace concept in which the more data customer will give, the more benefit from the lending side it will bring. But it can easily go into the other direction that customers are not providing consents at all. They are just withdrawing allowance to process their data, and they still expect some kind of a service that should be done on something much more basic. I don't want bank to know that I just bought a coffee. That's not none of your business. That's actually my coffee, and you should know how much money I'm making and if I can repay the loan. That's all.
You talk about open banking in the UK. A lot of the discussion is around gambling, and you can kind of understand why somebody, a lender, might be worried if they see a lot of gambling activity and saying, well, this consumer might spend a lot more in one month than another because of the nature of gambling. But the other hand, you can also see somebody who says, well, I just put a few bucks on the football result each weekend. It's not a big deal, but now my bank's punishing me, and so I'm going to open a second account. And we see a lot of that in the UK, where there's people just open a second card and use it for the sort of spend they don't want their banks to be aware of, which then, you know, dilutes the open banking. But that's in part because there's not that trust yet. The consumer doesn't trust the lender. So it is a balance we've got to find.
The interpretation of data is changing very fast. And the insights that you pull out from the data is changing faster and faster. And my observation is that the way you put your models together, your decisioning model and your decisioning process, requires more and more effort to keep it going, to make it same as good as in the moment of creation. Even 10 years ago, when models was built, it was good for 3-4 years. Right now, if you want to be in the top, you have to invest more and more in your analytics team and in your data processing and data enriching capabilities just to keep on going.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
There is a huge shortage of people that are good in analytics, and vendors, banks, lenders, they are desperately wanting people with this type of skills.
Yeah, and we talk often about decisioning, as we've kind of done a bit earlier today. And it's kind of a who gets the loan and who doesn't get the loan. But really, we usually turn it into a price. So at what price am I willing to lend to the customer? And then from that, is that a price I can or am willing to charge? And then if not, turn it into decline. And I see that in terms of risk-based pricing, actually, not long ago, you just released a wonderful document with our mutual friend and a probably best friend of the show, Jakob Fehrmann, out of the Danish office of Experian. What was that paper about, and what was the inspiration on taking a fresh look at risk-based pricing?
Thank you for asking that, and cheers to Jakob, of course. This was inspired by Jakob's client and the discussion that we had about, should we have risk-based pricing? And I thought that everything was said about risk-based pricing already and everybody knows, but apparently it is not. So we started to discuss with the client what are the strong and what are the weak side of having risk-based pricing and what can be the potential consequences. Now, my personal experience is pretty much like that. It's quite easy to make a decision we want a risk-based pricing. It's a little bit more difficult, but still not that difficult to build a proper process and models. It's kind of difficult to implement it right, because here in this moment, I've seen in my life, I will not say where, a few implementations that failed. It's extremely difficult to keep it ongoing and not to get spoiled and not to get adverse selection. And of course, probably my colleagues from analytics will say, no. If you build the right models, if you do everything right in the beginning, then you have no problem at all. And they are probably right. But if I charge good clients too much, they will simply walk away to the competition. If I open the doors too wide and I will start to invite customers that generate risk. So you should do a lot of exercise around. You should do the good stress testing. You should understand what can be the beneficial and what can be the issues with the decision you take. You should also understand what you want to achieve. Do you want to get more high margin, riskier customer, or other way around? You want to get more a prime customers for a little bit lower pricing, but also more predictable behavior of those clients in the future. And we also took a while and started to wonder how to implement it in, controlled environment, because it requires a little bit different approach. So it's not like, here is the scale, good customers, medium customers, bad customers, and we approve those. We approve those, but we are not happy about it, and we reject those. This is not that simple as I thought it is. So the base rules and the playground is the same, but the technology behind is completely different. And the capabilities of decisioning engine or the models is also completely different. And I can even forecast what is the proximity of the client to accept the price. But if I make it too complicated, and if I apply, 10 models in the same moment, I may have difficulty to interpret the results. In a nutshell, we advise to do it step by step and do the proper change management.
Because as you said, it's such a simple concept, but how do you roll it out? In the old days, it was sending direct mail to somebody so you could control who saw the price. These days, it's price comparison websites. So you're thinking about your price relative to the competition, how big's the discount I can go, but how big do I need to go? Looking at propensity to take the offers becomes very complicated. But yes, let's bring it back to Poland now. We've spoken a lot about the technology changes, and that's kind of all good news. But the technology changes we've seen in lending happen within the context of the broader economy, and that's not so easy to just say it's all good news. As we sort of come through the pandemic, but now we're looking at higher interest rates and your costs of living rising around the world, what does the market look like and feel like in Poland at the moment?
So it's not an easy answer. Yeah, we do have high inflation rate in Poland. The number of clients taking loans is decreasing. At the same moment, credit risk reports show that the market is in a very good shape. Even non-banking financial lenders that are typically doing more riskier clients, they are also in a good shape. So I would say credit risk or the capital requirements, the stability of the banking sector is not an issue. We had two banks under the resolution procedure. The process itself was done in a very professional way. Consumers, I think they didn't even notice that it happened, but the logo of the bank is different now. So that's the main change. On the other hand, back in 2004 to 2009, the banking sector was using a lot of foreign currency mortgages, typically in Swiss francs. It was a good idea those days, everybody thought, because the margins on the Swiss francs were way lower than on the Polish zlotys and customers could afford higher loan. But in 2008, everything changed. The value of Swiss franc went rapidly up. And customers, because of the construction of those loans, ended up with twice as much Polish zlotys to repay. And sadly, this was not regulated or solved by anyone. So customers were somehow encouraged to go to public courts and start to sue banks. And they started to win. The result of that is that the trust between the banks and the consumers is at stake. Now, I think that the CEOs of the banks are mentioning that they perceive legal risk as the most important and the most terrifying one. Because when the lawyers started to win against FX loans, now they started to question that perhaps the way that the interest rate for the Polish zlotys loans is also wrong. And if you imagine all the credits in Polish zlotys could be right now reset to zero margin, and the banking sector should take this in their course, there is no banking sector anymore. But like I said, the market is in pretty good shape. The daily banking quality and the level of service is amazing. You have everything in your app, in your phone. You have very secured money transfers. It's way faster than in Western Europe. It's not that fast as in India. The provision of loans is also very good. I think we can say that there are no excluded consumers so everyone can get a loan done in a fair way. There is very good blooming buy now, pay later market, and people are using it and like it. Yeah, and I think that the market is pretty well managed.
It does seem like, as we, I think, globally face some tough times, that after COVID or even after COVID, it could be worse, I guess, is the universal messaging. Bartek, as we wrap up here, what is it that's keeping you busy?
I'm in a change period because Experian unfortunately decided to close its operations in Poland and they are withdrawing from the CE region. I really regret that because I believe that Experian delivers top quality software and services. They have this fantastic know-how of how to use data, how to build the models, and how to organize the whole framework around the decision-making. But like I said, they are leaving Poland and we are splitting. So it's not decided what I will do further on. The group of my friends are inviting me to start a risk consultancy company in Asia, and thinking about India because this is their, let's say, home market, and they spend a lot of time there. And we really do have, you know, a combination of experience and know-how and thinking about the process. And this is really interesting. But I'm also in a conversation about working for a really amazing company that offers cutting-edge products from, among others, area of how to lend money to strangers, meaning the decision area, something that I love the most, I think. So I'm unable to answer you right now, and time will tell. But I think one of those...
I wish you the best of luck with making that decision and then following your future from there. Really interesting talking about Poland because it's a country that has had the sort of geopolitical changes alongside all the other changes we know so well, and on a timeline that is so similar to what I experienced in South Africa. But as we said right at the start, you know, from the other side of the world and with a very different history. So it's been really interesting for me. Yeah, thank you again for your time and hope to see you again somewhere in the future.
Thank you so much, Brendan. And I really invite you to see Poland and visit us. That's a really nice country, especially right now in the spring.
And thank you all for listening. Please do look for and follow the show on your favorite podcast platform and share the updates widely on LinkedIn, where lending nerds are found in our largest concentration. Plus, send me a connection request while you're there. This show is written and recorded by myself, Brendan LaGrange, in Brighton, England. Show music is by I Am Wake, and you can find show notes and written transcripts at www.howtolendmoneytostrangers.show. And I'll see you again next Thursday.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.